it's Friday the 8th of August and welcome to Career 24. I'm your host, Hwan Jung-woo. A special counsel team investigating allegations related to former First Lady Kim Gun-hee continues to mull whether to request another arrest warrant to question former President Yoon Suk-yeol. Meanwhile, his legal team has decried such attempts as illegal. We'll have more details in news briefing shortly. Coming up for our in-depth, we look back at the role young women played in the impeachment protests from late last year, but why women continue to struggle to break through as politicians. And then on Movie Spotlight, we review a local indie drama about a disabled woman going through pregnancy and a spin-off from the John Wick franchise. Let's begin with 24. Special Counsel Min Joong-gi's team is deliberating whether to seek a fresh warrant to arrest jailed former President Yoon Suk-yeol for questioning after its failure to execute the warrant this week. To give us latest on the stalemate between the special counsel and the former president, as well as some of our other headlines of the day, we have with us in the studio our KBS World Radio news editor, Koo Hee-jin. Hee-jin, hello.
Hello, Jamal.
Now, this, of course, comes after the counsel team failed in its second attempt to bring in Yoon for questioning due to his strong resistance. What more do we know?
Well, Deputy Special Counsel Moon Hong-ju said on Friday during a press briefing that as the arrest warrant for Yoon expired on Thursday, the team is deliberating whether to request a fresh warrant while reviewing various issues. Asked if the team intended to seek a new warrant to bring Yoon in for questioning, Moon said that while the principle is to bring him in, new circumstances have arisen that require careful consideration. Moon added that sending Yoon to trial without seeking a fresh arrest warrant is one of the options under consideration.
And Yoon's legal representatives have denounced the special counsel's team's actions, saying its latest attempt to arrest Yoon was illegal. They've also vowed to take legal action through criminal complaints and a constitutional petition. Can you explain?
Well, a statement from Yoon's legal representatives on Friday said the special counsel team's second attempt to bring Yoon in for questioning Thursday was not only unlawful, but amounted to physical abuse against a former head of state. They argued that forcibly trying to question a detained suspect who has already refused to cooperate was coercive and abusive, constituting a violent attempt by investigative authorities to coerce testimony. The team further asserted that the move was politically motivated, accusing the prosecution of weaponizing the law as a form of retaliation.
Meanwhile, Yoon's former Interior Minister, Lee Sang-min, who is in custody over allegations related to the December 3rd martial law incident, filed for a court review of the legality of his pretrial detention on Friday. And we're hearing that the hearing has just ended. What's the latest?
Well, the Seoul Central District Court held a hearing to review Lee's habeas corpus petition at 4:10 p.m., which concluded after approximately 1 hour and 40 minutes. At a regular briefing on Friday, Assistant Special Prosecutor Park Ji-young stated that five prosecutors participated in the hearing, reportedly submitting an 85-page visual presentation and a 110-page written opinion, arguing that former Minister Yi's detention should be upheld. Park explained that there had been no significant change in circumstances since Yi was detained last Friday, emphasizing that maintaining his custody remained necessary. Yi is facing charges of playing a key role in an insurrection, abusing his power, obstructing the exercise of other people's rights, and perjury. The court has to deliberate on the matter, and under the Criminal Procedure Act, the court is required to question suspects and investigate related evidence within 48 hours of such request being filed.
Let's turn to some other headlines now. A bipartisan bill was introduced in the US Congress aimed at exempting allied and partner nations such as South Korea and Japan from maritime duties and regulations. This comes as Washington seeks to cooperate with South Korea in restoring America's shipbuilding industry. Can you explain a bit further for us, please?
Well, Democratic Party Congressman Ed Case and Republican Congressman Jim Moylan tabled the put the Merchant Marines Allies Partnership Act on August 1st, which is designed to supplement loopholes in the Merchant Marine Act of 1920, better known as the Joneses Act. The Jones Act currently restricts domestic shipping to vessels that are U.S.-built, U.S.-flagged, U.S.-owned, and U.S.-crewed for national security. But it is assessed to be outdated, to have undermined the competitiveness of the American industry. The tabled act exempts vessels purchased from allied nations from being subject to restrictions under the Jones Act, as well as the current 50% import duty on major vessel modifications, as well as the work is done in shipyards in allied or partner countries.
Meanwhile, U.S. President Donald Trump's reciprocal tariffs went into effect Thursday, affecting countries around the world. Welcoming the changes, U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer has declared an end to the global trade order under the World Trade Organization and the start of a whole new system. Can you give us more details?
Well, on Thursday local time, the White House said products from 60 countries and the European Union will face tariffs of at least 10%, 15% for South Korea, Japan and the EU, and 20% for Taiwan, Vietnam and Bangladesh. South Korea, Japan and the EU reduced their rate to 15% in exchange for pledges to invest hundreds of billions of dollars in America. In an op-ed piece in the New York Times, the U.S. Trade Representative Jamison Greer said the world is witnessing a new trade order under what he called the Trump Round, a reference to the Uruguay Round of trade negotiations, which reformed the global trading system in the late 80s and early 90s, leading to the creation of the World Trade Organization. Greer said the Bretton Woods system, adopted during the World War II and later the WTO system, tasked with regulating the trade policies of its 166 member countries, were untenable and unsustainable, citing U.S. deindustrialization, foreign protectionism, and China's exploitation of global trade rules. The trade official said Washington's trade deals with South Korea and the EU, which include significant commitments to invest in the U.S. productive capacity, will accelerate U.S. Reindustrialization, specifically mentioning how South Korea will help reinvigorate the U.S. shipbuilding industry.
In other news, a senior U.S. official has said that the United States takes note with interest of a recent statement from Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of the North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, which suggested the possibility of dialogue with the U.S. while rejecting any talks on denuclearization. Can you tell us more?
Yes. Seth Bailey, acting Deputy Assistant Secretary in the State Department's Bureau of East Asian and Pacific Affairs, made the remarks Thursday during an event at the Defense POW MIA accounting agency, hosted for the families of troops who have gone missing, mostly during the Korean War. Now, here's what he had to say.
The President has offered to engage Chairman Kim Jong-un on multiple occasions. We have also seen high-level statements from the DPRK leadership, including recent statements from Kim Yo-jong, which we note with interest.
Bailey, who also serves as the U.S. Deputy Special Representative for North Korea, said the new South Korean administration has taken meaningful steps to reduce tensions on the Korean Peninsula and has shown a willingness to engage with North Korea. Let's listen further.
I know the Republic of Korea shares our goal, and we will continue to work closely with our ally on this critical issue. The new ROK administration has demonstrated a willingness to engage with North Korea, taking meaningful steps to reduce tensions across the Korean Peninsula.
We have also seen. He also stressed that the Trump administration remains committed to the principles outlined in the joint statement from the 2018 summit in Singapore between Kim Jong-un and U.S. President Donald Trump. Last week, Kim Yo-jong said the personal relationship between her brother and Trump is not bad, but ruled out the possibility of talks on denuclearization, instead urging Washington to change its thinking and adopt a new approach to Pyongyang.
Moving on, Unification Minister Chung Dong-young has pledged his best efforts to reopen dialogue with North Korea and make progress on the abductee and prisoner of war issues after the wife of an abductee pleaded tearfully on her knees for help on Friday. Can you tell us more?
Well, during a meeting with a civic group representing abductees' families, Kim Tae-ju, the wife of fishing boat captain Choi Jong-seok, who was abducted by North Korea in 1987, knelt before the minister and begged for confirmation of her husband's fate, saying she can no longer bear living without knowing whether he's alive. Chung comforted Kim, calling the decades-long separation a tragic situation and stressed that easing the suffering of abductees' families requires keeping dialogue with the North alive and open.
That's where we're going to wrap up our news briefing. Thank you for those updates.
Thank you.
South Korea experienced intense political turbulence following former President Yoon Suk-yeol's declaration of martial law in late 2024. The nationwide protests that followed culminated in Yoon's impeachment and a snap presidential election in 2025. One striking aspect of the protests was the high participation of young women. And while that wave of civic engagement was historic, the election also revealed some troubling contradictions. For the first time since 2007, there were no female candidates on the presidential ballot. This not only raised questions about women's representation in Korean politics, but the election results also reaffirmed the sharp gender divide in how young people vote. To explore these issues further, we're joined by Professor Kim Hena of the Graduate School of International Studies at Seogang University, who's been closely studying these dynamics and recently written on the topic as well. She joins us on the line. Professor Kim, hello and thank you for joining us today.
Hello, thanks for having me.
So as I said, you recently published an article on this topic and you began by noting that young women were at the forefront of the impeachment protests. How involved were young women in the protests? Just how many were there? Can you tell us a bit more? And what political significance do you think that had?
Right. So as you mentioned, you know, young women in their 20s and 30s, often referred to as the 2030 or like 2030 women, were highly involved in the protests that took place, you know, that occurred in response to the martial law attempt by former President Yoon on December 3rd. And many of these 2030 women mobilized rapidly and they grouped together in front of the National Assembly soon after the attempt. And the number of visible young women grew each week from the protest. So every time the protest took place, we saw more and more young women at the forefront. And this was in general relative to other protests as well. There were at least visibly a lot more women protesters not on the sidelines, but actually at the front. And of course, it's difficult to actually count and see if more women were involved. Some articles state that 1 in 3 protesters were women. These statistics are hard to confirm. But what we do know from cell phone and transportation card data is that during at least one of the mass demonstrations near the National Assembly, young women made up an estimated 30% of the hundreds of thousands of protesters. And additionally, an analysis by Newstapa found that women in their 20s and 30s accounted for the largest share, that was about 1/3. And what was surprising to me was that the next largest group were men in their 50s. So young women were at the front, and then after them were men in their 50s. Still, one thing that was significant about these protests was that young women were much more visible. Right? Mm. We have seen that there are young women protesting everywhere, but they were just much more visible this time. And it may be in part because the impeachment protests were unique. You know, they were peaceful, as is often the case in a lot of these protests. But also they utilized digital platforms and K-pop fandom culture to organize and amplify their message. And they employed creative methods using K-pop light sticks and festive attire to really transform these traditional protests into more ones based on solidarity and resistance. So while there were grievances, this was also an opportunity for young women to protest against Yoon's policies. And in many ways, the visibility of young women in these protests marked a shift away from South Korea's traditionally male-dominated protest culture.
Right. You mentioned the light sticks. It appears that for young women that it was they were seen as being responsible for starting that trend with these protests. So the question is, what do you believe brought the young women out to the streets to protest like this time?
But I actually just wanted to mention, you know, these light sticks are quite expensive. So it is very surprising that they did bring them out, and they had a lot of different light sticks. But, you know, I think in general, there were so many reasons that young women came out to protest. It was essentially an accumulation of grievances that really grew over time. So over the past, you know, 2 years, we saw a lot of these grievances grow. As I mentioned briefly, you know, Yoon's feminist anti-feminist policies and rhetoric really played a role in these growing grievances. The Yoon administration has a track record of dismissing feminist concerns and appealing much more to anti-feminist sentiments, especially ones among young men. And this was clear even before he became president. Like during his campaign, he mentioned abolishing the Ministry of Gender Inequality, and this rhetoric and value system became stronger throughout his administration. So as a result, many young women saw his presidency as openly hostile to gender equality, and particularly them, right? Mm. And so because of that, they felt marginalized, and women's voices in general in government seemed to really be disappearing. So even prior to the protests, young women have continuously expressed frustration over rising femicide and public safety issues, many of which have been highlighted on the news. You know, they also have concerns related to job insecurity, which is an issue for all young people, but particularly for young women who need to deal with workplace gender discrimination, even if they get employed, and social expectations around marriage and caregiving, which stem from traditional values, but also external pressures now, especially because of issues related to population decline. So as a result of this, it seems as though young women have been attempting to push for a broader cultural shift towards feminist consciousness. This really started around 2016 when South Korea saw the growth of feminist movements such as the Me Too movement. I don't even know if it's proper to say it's feminist movement. It was a pro-woman movement. Mm. But Yoon seemingly anti-woman stance may have stopped part of this development. So the impeachment protests really just gave this young woman a platform to turn their personal frustrations into political action. And these grievances have just contributed to a growing sense of urgency to act. And of course, you know, the ultimate and immediate trigger that allowed for this was the declaration of martial law, which was viewed as a blatantly authoritarian move. But for young women who are already feeling political marginalized, you know, it just provided them this platform, and especially because this act itself felt like a red line being crossed.
Right. You mentioned the 2016 Me Too protests. So were women not typically politically that active in South Korea compared to men in the past? And how have political protests changed over time, do you think?
Well, women have been consistently politically active, especially in Korea's modern history. It's very difficult to say in traditional history because a lot of women, even if they were politically active, you know, they weren't visible, and it was very difficult. They were usually not the main people that were, you know, focused on. And, you know, especially in the past, it's difficult to say that young women in particular were more politically active than other demographics. So in that sense, the way in which they have been active, as well as their visibility and scope, has changed. You know, women were still politically active in the anti-colonialism protests that took place over decades from 1910 to 1940. Some were just larger than others. And they were also very active in the democracy protests that took place in the 1980s. But were they the dominant demographic? Especially were young women the dominant demographic? That's very hard to say. But in recent years, we've seen the main protests where women have been viewed to be dominant have always been one that were based on gender and based on women's rights. So the rise of concerns related to women's rights, which really grew, as I mentioned earlier, from during the Me Too movement. This was a worldwide movement. So women in South Korea were also just able to find support worldwide, and they were also able to become more active. But also the anti-spy cam or the MoCA protests that took place both between around 2016 to 2018. That's where we really saw large groups of young women mobilizing to address issues related to sexual abuse and assault. But again, it's because it's directly affecting them, right? So it was very difficult to see them in more of the general protests, but more so among protests that were directly, you know, affecting them. So in many ways, this impeachment protest was kind of a first in modern history where young women were highly visible in protests that weren't specifically related, you know, to gender equality or women's rights, though it seems that was a sideline on.
Right. So as you've noted, young women were especially visible and significant. They had a significant presence at the impeachment protests. But despite that, it's been noted that the ballot for the 2025 snap election did not have a single female candidate for the first time since 2007. And you even put it in your article that while the protest space has become more inclusive, electoral politics remains exclusionary. So what's behind this phenomenon, do you think? Why do you think it is so persistent?
Right. So as you mentioned, there are no female candidates, or there were no female candidates in the 2025 snap election. And this is a first since 2007. And in many ways, it reflects a deep paradox where women have, you know, so to speak, transformed the streets, but they still remain excluded from traditional politics. And we often see this with more marginalized groups that are, it's very difficult for them to break the glass ceiling that to really go into traditional politics. But the gap between protest inclusivity and electoral exclusion has been shaped by many different factors, many of which are structural, cultural, and strategic, and they remain stubborn. So there are some main structural barriers. There's party gatekeeping, which continues to be a problem. You know, major parties continue to remain highly centralized in Korea, with candidate selection controlled usually by a smaller, much more male-dominated group. So there are significant divisions within some major parties, as we have seen in the PPP this past snap election, for example, have really further exacerbated this. And in addition, there's the issue of campaign financing. Running for president in Korea is very expensive, and it requires large personal networks and fundraising ability. But these are areas where men have an advantage because women have historically been excluded from these circles or these networks. So, and in addition to that, in general, the image of a president in Korea seems to be viewed much in a much more masculine way. You know, I think it's in part of this is a historical, cultural, traditional thing where we've even seen that where Confucian values will emphasize paternal authority, right? And it kind of makes the implicit assumption that the leader is often a male figure. And in general, even in, aside from this, there are less women in different political levels. And so when there are policies that are made to increase women in government, it doesn't always work in action.
Well, despite there being no female candidates, young women came out in strong numbers and their votes helped propel President Lee Jae-myung to win the election. Around 58% of women voters in their 20s and 57% in their 30s voted for Lee of the Democratic Party. That was according to a joint exit poll by the three broadcasters at the time. And this mirrored the 2022 presidential election. However, that was in stark contrast to their male counterparts. And this is something I want to explore with you as well. A majority of young men in their 20s and 30s picked Kim Moon-soo of the People Power Party and Lee Jun-suk, another conservative candidate. What do you think that tells us about the gender divide in politics in Korea at the moment? What implications do you think it has?
Yeah, isn't it very interesting and also slightly concerning that we were seeing this growing gender divide among young people? And I think in many ways this really provides a clear example of how divided society is, especially in Korea among young people. And there was an article in the Financial Times that came out last year, from what I recall, and it was showing that among various countries, South Korea showed the largest gender gap in terms of political ideology. And it showed how young women were leaning progressive and young men were leaning conservative. And the article included graphs to compare the different countries, and South Korea's was by far showing the starkest contrast. So in many ways, we've seen this growing gender divide, as you mentioned, since 2022, but it has been growing particularly up because young men are starting to lean more right. And the results of the election worked in line with this and showed that this was not just based on public opinion. You know, young women in their 20s, mostly the majority voted for Lee Jae-myung, while young men in their 20s voted majority for one of the two conservative candidates. And in many ways, many young male voters may have voted for Lee Jun-seok because of his anti-feminist stance that we have seen over the years, but also because they may just have wanted to vote conservative, but they also didn't want to vote for Kim Moon-soo and the PPP because they were disappointed by all of the fragmentation that was taking place. But what is clear is that they refused to vote for progressive parties, right? And they were very clearly showing that they wanted to remain conservative. And so, if the two conservative parties merged, the conservative side may have won because of the support of young men, and that may have played a big role. So as a result, this growing divide among young women and young men may further exacerbate differences. And we're seeing this in society as well. The digital world is also further exacerbating it. And the concern is that we've seen this gap grow from 2022 to now, and will it continue to grow even more? I think that's the concern.
Okay, so let's look at how the current administration is perhaps considering some of these issues. Do you think they are recognizing and responding to it? And how do you evaluate the administration's policy directions and prioritization when it comes to gender issues since taking office?
I don't think there have been many issues that have been prioritized regarding gender, but part of it may be because it's still too soon. Lee Jae-myung is very busy right now addressing many of the issues that have appeared during the political vacuum that took place since last December. A lot of them are focused on foreign policy. And it's very likely that in the administration right now, gender issues are not a priority. Of course, there have been some discussions since the campaign of the snap election. In the past, Lee had promised policy moves, including preserving the Ministry of Gender and Equality, and he has in the past committed to women holding at least 30% of ministerial positions, though actual implementation, we don't really know. So some of these commitments were made in the past, but the recent campaign also sidestepped many of these gender-specific proposals, and the word woman was very noticeably absent from many of the pledges. And at a certain point, I think when he was asked about this, he even questioned why women and men were being divided and in a way may have seemingly dismissed it. So in that sense, there has not been a lot of progress, but there should be in the future.
You mentioned there the Ministry of Gender Equality and Family and how the current Lee Jae-myung administration has said that it will try to revive it. Under former President Yoon Suk-yeol, he had wanted to abolish the ministry, and there still remain critics who question whether it has helped resolve gender equality issues or not. And there is a situation at the moment. Currently, the minister position has remained vacant for over 16 months as well. But do you think there is a role for the ministry to play to try and tackle some of these issues, and how so?
I think in theory, the Ministry of Gender and Equality can play a central role in addressing this widening gender gap. But as you mentioned, the ministry has been vacant, and there were also a lot of issues with the ministry even prior to all of this as well, and even before Yoon. So its effectiveness really depends heavily on how it will be reorganized and expanded, if at all. Right now, the ministry needs to focus on gaining more public legitimacy, since many view it as a biased platform for women, or they even view it as just being inefficient. And these kind of views of the ministry erode its ability to build consensus. In relative to the other ministries, it has a smaller budget and just little enforcement power. So the fact that the Ministry of Gender and Equality has been vacant for over 16 months and there's no sense of urgency regarding this signals how low gender issues are as a priority. So right now, even before considering whether the ministry can help solve these issues, we need to see if the ministry can function again, whether it can be reorganized in a way in which it can be effective and prioritize gender issues in a way in which both young women and young men don't feel targeted or divided.
Okay, so then what would you finally like to see from the Lee administration? Any policy or political signals or policies? How would you advise the government as well? What should they be looking at, do you think?
There's no clear or simple answer to this, but the first steps are necessary to defuse gender polarization just because we're seeing it grow. Because the Lee administration has not fully addressed this, first administration needs to send clear, early, and sustained signals that it views gender equality as a priority. So one way might be to, as I mentioned earlier, to reorganize and appoint a credible and consensus-building leader to actually lead the ministry, and someone who will not focus on creating opposition or divisions, but can be respected across the political spectrum might be key, though this is much easier in theory than in practice. But only in that way can we really see less hostility towards issues related to women. And I think at the same time, issues related to equality should not be outsourced to one small ministry. It should be integrated into policies that are prioritized within the administration. So the Lee administration seems to have been avoiding gender issues to avoid flaming the fire, but framing gender issues as an economic and demographic imperative can also help avoid issues that come up with identity politics that can often add fuel to the flame. And in that sense, this would allow for more opportunities for many young people, including groups that are marginalized.
Well, we will see how the gender issues in politics continues to evolve under this administration and beyond. But for today, we will leave it there. We'll be speaking to Professor Kim Hena from the Graduate School of International Studies at Sargang University. Thank you once again for sharing your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Welcome to the Korea 24 Stock Market Update. The benchmark Korea Composite Stock Price Index lost 17.67 points, or 0.55% Friday, to close at 3,210.01. The tech-heavy KOSDAQ gained 3.46 points, or 0.43%, to close at 809.27. You can check for Korean stock market updates at world.kbs.co.kr.
We continue on to Korea Trending, our daily segment where we round up some of the most viewed stories and issues on Korean news outlets outside of our main news briefing headlines. And joining us in the studio now to bring us those stories, we have with us Daniel Che, KBS World Radio News Editor. Daniel, hello, it's good to see you.
Good to see you too, Changho.
What do you have for us first?
In most establishments like restaurants and supermarkets in Korea, you can easily find convenient kiosks that help with your order or purchases. But while rushing to quickly have the kiosk widely available, we may have rushed without keeping the needs of the disabled community in mind.
Yes, Korea has been very quick to adopt these kiosks in recent years, but it does look like there has been a major oversight of the disabled community along the way. What sort of difficulties are we talking about experienced by different groups in terms of accessibility?
The Ministry of Health and Welfare released a 2024 report on the Act on the Prohibition of Discrimination Against Persons with Disabilities. And based on a survey conducted from last October to this January with 540 participants, 7 in 10 respondents with visual impairments, 6 in 10 wheelchair users said they would rather order from a staff member than use a kiosk. 45% said they preferred ordering through a staff member. Some 10% said they feel pressure from others waiting in line.
Yes, even for able-bodied individuals in a rush or with a long queue behind them, it can be quite a nerve-wracking experience working in an unfamiliar kiosk. So what kind of changes can we expect?
Well, under the revision to the anti-discrimination law, all kiosk operators will be required to install barrier-free kiosks with accessibility features for people with disabilities and the elderly starting from next January. They must meet official accessibility standards, which include functions like font enlargement and voice guidance for users with low vision. The ministry plans to revise relevant regulations and expand the availability of accessible kiosks, publish guidelines for kiosk operators, and the Ministry of SMEs and Startups is providing subsidies for small business owners to purchase or rent barrier-free kiosks through its Smart Store program.
Well, it looks like some of these changes could make a big difference for many people, but how quickly and effectively they're implemented will be key. For now, it's at least encouraging to see steps being taken. Let's move on to our next story. Next Friday, August 15th, Korea celebrates a National Liberation Day, marking the nation's liberation from Japan's colonial rule. And the National Museum of Korean Contemporary History is holding a special exhibit to mark the occasion. Can you tell us more?
That's right. To mark the 80th anniversary of this historic day, the museum is holding a special exhibit on the national flag, Taegukki. Some 200 pieces of items, including pictures featuring the flag, as well as historical flags that have been preserved, are on display. To give you a brisk history, following the trend for modern states to adopt national flags, the decision to create a national flag for Korea emerged with the ratification of the Korea-United States Treaty of 1882. By order of on March 6, 1883, King Gojong promulgated that the flag with a Taegukki circle in the center and four trigrams around it be the national flag. And due to a lack of specific guidelines, the flag design took different forms, which led to various sizes and shapes of Taegukki being produced. And on June 29, 1942, the provisional government issued a national flag style guide to ensure that subsequent flags would be created in a consistent manner.
Yes, every piece are priceless treasures, I'm sure. But still, can you shed light on some of the highlights that people should look out for?
Sure thing. These include Taegukki, which was previously owned by American Christian missionary William Arthur Noble, as well as a copy of the French daily Le Petit Journal that covered the booth of the Korean Empire during the 1900 Paris Exposition. And there are some 20 Taegukki registered as state-designated cultural assets, not to mention the one that was on display at France's Gemme Museum, but latterly found by Korean researchers in the 1990s, that's being displayed in home Seoul for the first time. Owen Denny's Taegukki stand out for its historical value. It is known to be the oldest and the largest among the Taegukki with historical values measuring 262 centimeters by 182.5. The flag was part of a collection held by Owen Nickerson Denny, an American diplomatic advisor to King Gojong in 1886, who received the flag as a gift.
Well, it sounds like it will be a meaningful exhibition indeed. Turning our attention to the world of sports next, the biggest news in the football realm in Korea remains Son Heung-min's move to LAFC of the MLS, the U.S. Pro Football League, and a fellow Korean sports star based in the City of Angels has delivered a warm, welcoming message. Can you tell us more?
That star is Kim Hye-sung of the LA Dodgers. He sent a video message to congratulate and welcome Son. The Major League Baseball team sent a number of video messages via the official social media site. Tommy Hyunsu Edmund, who also plays for the LA squad, joined in. The message was simple and straightforward but heartfelt. Both players unable to contain their excitement as fellow athletes, but more so as fans of the legendary football star. Kim vowed to spare no effort in rallying Son on as he begins a new phase of his career.
Right, and actually Kim and Son have deeper connections than just being fans of each other or being fellow countrymen, right? In some sense, they are business partners.
Yes, they do have the business connection. In 2024, Kim signed with CAA to join Son as athletes affiliated with the mega global talent management agency. How big is CAA? Other than Son Heung-min, who is a mega global superstar in football, one baseball name that signed to it says it all, Shohei Ohtani. Mm. It is highly likely to see these stars showing up at each other's sporting arenas to show support as well as other events and be busy mingling and taking photos. LA soccer fans are counting the seconds to kick off to see number 7 of LAFC take the field and strut his stuff. In the official introductory presser for Son, loaded with posters and jerseys in both Korean and English, he was welcomed by more than just officials of his new team. Big names in various arenas, including politicians, such as L.A. Mayor Karen Bass was there. Unfortunately, it was a confused L.A. council member who told Son Heung-min that he should get the support he needs to help the United States win the World Cup next year. Apparently mistaken the Korean star who played for Tottenham Hotspur as an American.
That's where we're going to wrap up today's Korea Trending. Daniel, thank you for those stories.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's time now for Movie Spotlight, our weekly segment on a Friday where our film critics give us their recommendations on what to watch over the weekend among the latest releases here in Korea. And joining us in the studio for that, first we have Jason Bechevais. Jason, hello, it's good to see you.
Yeah, great to be here.
And we also have with us Darcy Paquette as well. Darcy, hello to you too.
Hello.
Okay, so we begin as usual with a Korean film. It's actually a quiet week in cinemas, with no major Korean films being released this week. But Darcy, you have brought for us a low-budget independent film that was released last week. It's called Between the Two of Us, or 우리 둘 사이에 in Korean. And it first screened at the Jeonju International Film Festival last year, I understand. Can you tell us more about it, Darcy?
Yes, it's a debut film. The director's name is Song Ji-hae. And the story centers around a young woman named Eunjin, who at the age of 18, she gets into an accident and she becomes paralyzed from the waist down. When the film starts, she's in her mid-30s. She's newly married to her longtime boyfriend. And, you know, although she's dealing with, you know, various kinds of inconveniences and, you know, casual discrimination due to living her life in a wheelchair. Mm. In another respect, she has, I mean, kind of an ideal life in some ways. And then one day she discovers that she's 8 weeks pregnant. And, you know, this wasn't planned. The couple had kind of envisioned themselves growing up with, you know, growing old with just the two of them. And so the news throws them into a state of confusion. You know, her husband and her mother as well are both kind of worried for her on her behalf because just because of the physical demands of pregnancy, and they're worried that, you know, being in a wheelchair, this might create additional complications. And, you know, she herself is not sure about the medical issues involved either, but, you know, she asks her doctors, and as time passes, she becomes more and more determined to have the child. And so the couple, yeah, I mean, ultimately, the film is a story about a pregnancy. Mm. And there have been other films that have focused on the course of a pregnancy. This one has a different perspective because it, you know, is being told from the point of view of a character who's disabled.
Right. So as you said, a familiar story, but with a fascinating twist, actually. Without giving away spoilers, can you tell us a bit more how the pregnancy goes for her, just so we get a sense of the tone of the film as well?
Yeah, I mean, it's not an easy pregnancy. And so at times she worries that, you know, her disability might be an issue that, you know, it's causing the problems. And, you know, she's taking regular medication, which she continues to take on her doctor's recommendations, that she worries that might be the issue. But I think that, you know, more than that, I think that it's a lot of stress for her. And, you know, in some ways she's dealing with an extra layer of stress because, you know, everybody around her is kind of extra careful. And, again, like, you know, there's her mother who's kind of a bit of a pushy character. But, you know, as time goes on, you know, I think that all pregnancies are kind of inherently dramatic. And the film does capture that. You know, ultimately, the disability isn't really the issue,
right,
I think.
Right.
But it's definitely true that the stress and worry of the situation get to her.
Right. So it sounds like quite a moving drama, touching upon some other interesting, I guess, social commentary issues as well, such as disability and parenthood and whatnot, I'm sure. Darcy, what did you make of the film?
I mean, in the, what can I say? About three quarters of the way through the film, I was really enjoying it a lot. And, you know, I'd gotten really absorbed in the story, and I found the characters really believable and likable. And so I was really engaged with the story. I'm a little puzzled by some of the narrative choices that they made in telling the story. And so I can't really...
You mean towards the end?
Yeah, I can't really talk about it because it's it's spoilers. But,
of course.
You know, it... I was trying to think in my mind, you know, like why they may have taken the story in this direction. And, you know, maybe they wanted to make it a bit more dramatic. Maybe they felt that the story as it was wasn't dramatic enough. But actually for me it was. You know, I would have preferred a kind of a plainer story kind of going through to the end. Or, you know, perhaps it was based on a real life case. But even if it were, I think that dramatic, you know, in a narrative sense... So I can't say what I'm talking about, but I really liked the film up until the three quarters point. And then, you know, at the end, I was a little disappointed by the end, but I'm still glad I watched it.
Okay, so overall, not a bad film, you're saying, but just you found the ending a bit frustrating because you enjoyed the first half, the first three quarters so much.
Yeah, and I mean, sometimes you have a film that I think you can feel that it doesn't quite have enough self-confidence to just
The courage of its convictions.
Be ordinary. Yeah. Yeah. And there's a feeling that it needs to be kind of spiced up a bit when I think it would have been better if it wasn't.
Jason, did you catch this film as well?
Yeah, I did. I totally agree with Darcy. Yeah, I liked it quite a bit up until it kind of veered off into a different direction. I mean, Korean independent films can take things to the extreme. You know, they want to spice it up, like Darcy said. And I think it didn't need to, and it was a bit unfortunate in the way they decided to do that. But I like the performances, you know, by the, you know, the male and female lead. You know, Kim Soo is fantastic. And I, you know, there's so much focus in Korea, you know, on a low birth rate and there not being enough babies. And what I liked about this was actually it looked at, you know, a pregnant woman who just really wanted to be a mum, right? She really cared about her child. And there are many stories like that in Korea, despite, you know, the low birth rate. And so for me, that was quite refreshing, and seeing it from the perspective of, you know, a disabled character as well. And you can see some of the issues that she faces in Korea. And yeah, so I think there was enough there to take it right through to the end. And it was a shame that they had to kind of shift gears, which, you know, and I was just like,
I am curious about it, but I won't ask any more.
No, we can talk about it on the air.
Darcy, I'm curious about the actors in the roles as well. How did they fare carrying this story? The lead actor, she's not disabled herself, is she?
No, she's not. Her name is Kim Si-eun, and she's appeared in a lot of films to date. Like, if you look at her record, she's been acting in films since 2014 and has had a lot of roles, but most of them have been quite small roles. And so it's been in a couple independent films that she received a bit more attention. And so she got awards nomination for a couple films. But this film, I mean, she's really kind of at the center of the story. We see her almost in every scene. And yeah, you know, it could have been, I guess this is the kind of character who, like, it's not a really demonstrative character in terms of her personality. And she's the kind of person who, you know, smiles on the outside, even when she's kind of in a panic or, and, you know, she might kind of avoid saying things that lead to conflict. And so it's not the type of character that naturally leads to drama. And yet, you know, she gets all the subtle details so right that you just really start to feel
a
connection with the character.
Really interesting. So, yes, it sounds like a really interesting film with some great performances, with a caveat of the ending. Once again, it's called Between the Two of Us, and it's out now in select cinemas here in Korea. Let's turn to our international release now. It is a big Hollywood blockbuster spin-off. It's the latest in the John Wick franchise, in fact. It's called Ballerina and has the same title in Korean. And it stars Ana de Armas as a dangerous assassin in the John Wick universe. Jason, this is your pick this week. Can you tell us more about it?
Yeah, sure. So the John Wick films created by Derek Kolstad, you know, some of the kind of most iconic action films coming out of Hollywood, you know, over the last, you know, decade or so, amassing $1 billion at the box office. You know, Keanu Reeves stars as the infamous hitman who comes out of retirement to seek retribution because some men have killed his very precious dog. and there are four movies, and Ballerina is set between the third and fourth installments. And so this basically takes a very similar trajectory, you know, very, as you'd expect with this kind of high concept franchise, follows this female assassin played by Ana de Armas. And yeah, we see her from, you know, her childhood. You know, she sees her father who is killed, and she grows up obviously wanting to settle, you know, the, you know, seeking, you know, retribution, very angry following the death of her father, and settle the school. And so she does that, she seeks to do that throughout the, you know, more into our duration. There's a lot of killing that goes on, and it features an interesting cast. It includes Reeves, that comes, he appears at the beginning, And then towards the end, and I like that. It wasn't too little, not too much. Mm-hmm. And he stars alongside Angelica Huston, along with the late Lance Reddick, who passed away suddenly in March 2023. He's also in the other John Wick films. There's also some Korean talent involved as well. So with Girls' Generation, Choi Se-young, and the stunt choreographer and actor, Jung Doo-hong, who's worked extensively with the action maestro Yoo Sung-won. And Ballerina is directed by US filmmaker Len Wiseman. He made the Underworld movies, also the Live Free Die Hard film, as well as Total Recall, so, you know, the studio picks. And the film is also being marketed as From the World of John Wick Ballerina, so they obviously want to make it clear that it, you know, it's set in the John Wick universe.
Right, so the rather unwieldy title, but yeah, we'll just call it Ballerina. So, Jason, does it hit the heights of the other John Wick films then? What do you think?
I think it does, actually. You know, those movies, you know, feature these, you know, daring set pieces. And yes, there's a lot of them in this movie. There's you know, people getting blown to pieces. There's lots of shooting. And it's so kinetic, you know, it's constantly moving, engaging, you know, it's very well staged. The sound is incredible. I just watched an average screen, actually. I kind of wish I'd gone to see it in Dolby Atmos, but even in just a regular screen, the sound is quite something. Mm. So the production values are top notch. Mm. And, you know, great performances. And yeah, it's just great to look at, you know, some interesting, casting choices there. And, you know, we have a female lead as well. So, I mean, it does kind of make reference to, you know, clearly this is a female assassin, you know, killing lots of men.
Sure.
But, you know, the movie, it's, you know, the John Wick films, you know, the attract, you know, a lot of male viewers, and so it'll be interesting to see what the response is to this. But
is that the only thing that's particularly new about this film, that the fact that the lead is a female assassin? It sounds like it is treading similar path to the other
absolutely, and unashamedly so, and it works, I think. You know, these movies are not, you know, full of social commentary. You go and watch them for to see Keanu Reeves.
So Darcy, you've seen it as well then?
Yeah I have.
What did you make of it?
I mean, yeah, I really enjoyed it a lot. And yeah, I'm also an Anna de Armas fan ever since seeing her in Knives Out. And
yeah, Knives Out as well. She's terrific in that.
Mm. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, it's very kinetic. There's a lot of energy in the film. It never really kind of slows down. And so it keeps you going the whole time. And then, I mean, it has kind of interesting, fun little details as well. I mean, personally, there are a series of scenes where she comes across these big boxes, you know, filled with weapons, and then she'll open it up and she'll look inside. And each one, we kind of see her face and the reaction, but it's always really minor reaction. You know, she'll open it up and be filled with machine guns, and she'll be like, okay. then towards the end, she pulls it open, then she's like, wow, this one. And then we know that something big's coming up, but, you know, that they release, you know, the information kind of in a really clever sort of way. It's just a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, so it is quite carefully put together then. Interesting.
Mm. Oh, yeah, absolutely, yeah.
As you said, she put in a great performance. What about some of the Korean talent involved, as you mentioned? They're fairly minor roles, right?
Very minor. They appear fairly early on in the film for about, what, 3 or 4 minutes, is it, or something? Mm. And that's it. They barely say anything. Mm. You know, she's carrying out a mission, and, you see her, the female protagonist in the film, kind of going up against, you know, one of Korea's great choreographers, Jun Dong-on, and there's a fight sequence, and that's about it.
They're involved in
a fight sequence, and then, the Girls' Generation, because she's... I mean, Seong's huge, right? She's not just in Korea, but outside. And it's just a cameo, which I thought was a real shame. I wanted to see more of her.
I understand that the film although it was reviewed quite well, it didn't do very well in the US, right?
It didn't,
in
North
America. This has been out for a while now.
Yeah, timing's everything. So it's basically flopped in North America, grossing just, I think, $58 million there, despite, you know, strong, decent word of mouth and reviews. You know, some have suggested, some experts have suggested it was just released at the wrong time. You know, for genre fare, you tend to release that in the fall, or, you know, maybe spring or February, something like that. And yeah, I mean, actually I appreciated it because, you know, Korea's had this incredibly hot and oppressive summer, and and there are these amazing sequences set in Prague, you know, in Czech Republic, yeah. And it's just snow, and it's just and you have this like tan, and they're all full of assassins, and it's just rather humorous. But I loved that, and it's like, ah, oh, this feels nice and cold.
In your air-conditioned, very well air-conditioned cinema here in Korea.
But clearly, in America, you know, this, you know, releasing in the summer was probably not the smartest decision. I know what you did last summer, the remake of that, the horror film. That also bombed, and, you know, that given the title, they thought, well, that's released in the summer, but, you know, maybe releasing that during Halloween, or,
yeah.
You know, would have been a better decision. Not I haven't seen the film, and the reviews haven't been great for that, but, you know, horror films are doing pretty well at the moment. That is one of these genres that's proven quite resilient in the post-pandemic era, and so I think timing is everything, and it just came out at the wrong time, but it's a good film, so if you can watch it, I definitely watch it on the big screen with a, you know, the sound. Sound is, oh, superb. I love it. Yeah.
Okay, so that was Ballerina, out now in cinemas here in Korea. And that's it for another Movie Spotlight. Jason, Darcy, as ever, thank you for your reviews, and we'll catch up with you guys again next time. Take care.
Yeah, take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
And that brings us to the end of another week here on Korea 24. We'll be back on Monday, so do join us again then. I've been your host, Kwon Jang-woo, and thank you as always for listening. Goodbye.